Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang, where we continue the book Conversations with Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba, written by Dr. John Hislop. Today we have something very interesting in the sense that Dr. John Hislop will be virtually joining us because we have a little clip of him narrating a very interesting experience which is in relation with the conversation that's going to happen between him and Swami. So this session is going to be a continuation of last week. At the same time, it has some very interesting surprises coming up. So let's dive in directly, because I think last week we had stopped at a point where Hislop and Swami were discussing about the dream state and the waking state, and Hislop was telling Swami that in the dream state one feels it's very real, but in the waking state he is experiencing at times the feeling that this is all a dream and this is all unreal. So he was differentiating between the waking state and dreaming state in that manner. And what Swami tells after that is very, very interesting. But before we go into that, we offer our most humble pranams at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan. And let us all welcome Brother Prem as well. Sai Ram Prem.
Sai Ram Arvind, and Sai Ram to all our listeners. Yes, we were at a very important point. In fact, we did make a mention that the point that Hislop is making is not a very common one, which actually reveals how deep a thinker he is. And he certainly is speaking from a lot of experience, not only merely learning and reading, but also a certain amount of, I think, spiritual experience too. And just to give a short brief about that discussion which was happening, Swami was talking about how the dream state is unreal, and that is a common knowledge. But the waking state appears real, just like how things appear real when you're in a dream. And then you realize that when you wake up. So Swami was saying that the waking state is also like a dream where, you know, you're in it, so you don't realize how unreal it is. And all the emotions that go with the waking state, however real they may appear, they are still part of the waking dream. And that was the discussion. And Swami was, of course, talking about the relative unreality that you sense. And that is what gives away the dream state as being temporary and all of that. At that time, Hislop asked this question. He says, but Swami, there is another difference between the dream state and the waking state. In the dream state, one does not doubt his reality, whereas in the waking state, there is an extremely strong doubt. In the waking state, one cannot believe that he is a real entity. Mm-hmm. One sees himself as a shadow and not as a real person engaged in activity. So this is the question he asks. The thing which Swami was telling is, in a dream you feel it's real. In the waking state also it appears it's real. But Hislop is saying, Swami, but there is a difference, because in the waking state I do feel sometimes that this is unreal. I feel that this is a shadow, or, you know, I look at my body and say that this is not me. I think something similar to this he had mentioned earlier also in a discussion. He says that you do feel that this is not real. I'm looking at a person, but that person is not whom I'm really seeing. It's probably something in my mind. So I think he is making references to some very deep experiences that he's having, and that's the basis of this question that he is putting forth.
And like an expert doctor, Swami diagnoses that. Swami tells him, you see yourself as a shadow, and then there is a change, and you experience yourself as real. Like this, it changes back and forth. The two sides of a coin, the face and the obverse. And Hislop agrees. He says, yes, it is like that. Swami says, but that is not the typical experience of the waking state. It is a yogic stage due to sadhana. People ordinarily experience the dream state as truth while dreaming, and they experience the waking state as truth while awake. What you experience is qualified monism. It is an Advaitic state. What you experience is qualified monism. In the Advaitic state, even the shadow is seen as a reflection of the divine. So I think qualified monism is Vishishta Advaita.
Right.
Because monism is Advaitic and qualified is Vishishta Advaita. So Swami is saying that generally people are in the state of Dvaita always, because they experience everything when they're awake, they experience the waking state to be real. But since at times you are experiencing the waking state as unreal, Swami says you are in the stage of qualified monism. And Swami says that when you progress from that to the Advaitic state, even the unreal, what you're seeing as unreal, will be seen as a reflection of the same divine. It's just like the mirror's reflection is unreal, but it is reflecting the same being who is standing in front of the mirror. In that sense, Swami says, what you're experiencing is not a common experience for everyone. And I remember that we exclaimed when we read this last week, because Hislop says that in the dream it is very convincing, but in the waking state, I don't think that it is real. I feel that something unreal. This is what I'm experiencing. And that is definitely not what we experience in our day-to-day life. So it definitely points to a little advanced level in Hislop, and that is what Swami also emphasizes and says that you are experiencing this because of the sadhana that you have done. It's a yogic stage where you experience all these things.
Right, exactly. And I think that's what we were referring to last time also when we mentioned the example of Janaka. You know, when he comes out of the dream, pretty similar to what Hislop is saying here, he actually feels that this waking state is not real. That doubt comes whether this is the real state or that is the real state. Right? That's why he says, Adi Nijama, Adi Nijama. When you have an experience of the waking state being unreal, then Swami is saying that, and I think the last statement that he's making also is very, very profound. Swami is saying, what you experience is qualified monoism. This is again something that Swami would tell in his discourses, that you are actually traveling from Dvaita to Advaita through Vishishta Dvaita. And Swami would often say this, that through your spiritual sadhana, through your effort, you can come up till the Vishishta Dvaita state. Where being an individual entity, you are sensing that you're part of the whole. You are an illusion by the individuality is an illusion. And then Swami would say, but for going from that Vishishta Dvaita to the Advaita state, you need God's grace. So this again is a validation from Swami that, you know, through his sadhana he's reached that state. And the last statement that he's making is again something that we had discussed. I don't know in what context it came up. Even Sai Prakash was here for that session. Where I think the topic on discussion was prajna. What is the difference between prajna and normal jnana and prajnana and all of that. And he had made a reference to, I think, something which Ramakrishna Paramahamsa had said. Where he was saying that real prajnana is not the differentiation between the real and unreal. Where you see everything as part of the real. Everything is part of God. And I think that's what Swami is mentioning here. In the true Advaitic or non-dualistic state, even the shadow is seen as a reflection of the divine. So even what is illusory, you don't see it as illusory. It's you go to the other end of the spectrum. Actually, we are doing that right now. The illusory is appearing real to us. But Swami is saying that when you really go to the purest form, there is nothing which is non-divine. In that experience, you are established.
So, you know, it feels like there's no problem when we get this kind of doubts and dissatisfaction. But this is something Swami emphasized during we read about it during our conversation last week, where Swami is saying that it's so important that you have confidence. In fact, we also saw how Swami had mentioned in a discourse that one of the greatest sins that you can do is destroy the faith or self-confidence of somebody through your speech and talk. Therefore, self-confidence is so important. So while we go through this stage of doubt or a kind of disillusionment, wondering what is true, am I real, is this whole thing real, that is what even Emperor Janaka went through, that is what Hislop is going through. But beneath all this, there must be that self-confidence. I think the self-confidence that I will be able to, you know, get to the root of this, I will definitely be able to get the answer. The very fact that a question has arisen in me shows that I am now prepared to receive the answer. This kind of self-confidence has to be there. That should never be let gone of, because as Swami says, the mansion of self-realization is built on the foundation of self-confidence. So it's okay to get self-doubt. It's okay to get this kind of disillusionment. It's okay to get this question whether what is real, what is unreal. But as a basis of all this, self-confidence must definitely be there always.
And the point, I think, about self-confidence is very, very important. In some discourses, Swami says that these kind of experiences a lot of people have. Not necessarily a very spiritual experience like what Hislop is mentioning, But a lot of us, there is, you know, a sense of vairagya which comes. We have spoken about that many times. There are incidents which we experience in life which gives us a lot of vairagya.
Detachment. You
know, detachment instantly at that moment, especially the most powerful one they speak of is when you're seeing a body being cremated or when you see a person who is, you know, suddenly lost his life. It gives you a reality check as to, you know, what am I chasing in life, right? So in that sense, there are many, many moments we'll go through life where you have a sense of epiphany, you have a feeling of, you know, a wise thought comes. We don't pursue that because of lack of self-confidence. You know, that's what Swami would say, that, you know, you have an experience, you have a doubt, but you don't feel confident enough that you can resolve this doubt or you can go after this and find the answer. And so you miss a lot of these opportunities which come and go, and then you start pursuing your, you know, your regular life. So I think in one of the summer course discourses, I think we were referring to that a couple of weeks back also. Swami was saying that very clearly. It is not easy. It's very, very difficult. It's the, you know, the ultimate of human pursuits to find that jnana. But at the same time, you should not give it up. If you feel that there are so many people who have achieved it, why can't I achieve it? And Swami should say that when you look at all these great jnanis and sages and saints, you should feel they were also human, I am also human. If they have achieved it, even I can achieve it. Right? So that self-confidence which Swami started this entire discussion with, I think is a very, very important thing. And I think based on that, Swami is saying something to the students who happened to be there in that discussion which was happening.
Exactly. Because I think what you just now said, Swami amplifies that. Because Swami tells the college boys in the group there, it is necessary to understand topics such as these, although they are somewhat difficult to grasp. So he tells it to the students. And next, Swami turns back to Hislop and he asks, what is that beneath your shirt? Hislop takes out a chain from around his neck and he gives this chain to Swami. And instead of the pendant of the chain, there is a ring that is hanging there. And Hislop tells, Swami, it is the ring that you gave that is now broken. And Swami now passes around the ring to all the college boys for them to see. And asks Hislop, what do you want? And Hislop says, if Swami could repair the ring. You know, it's amazing how even a person of Hislop's caliber can, you know, forget the presence of the being in whose presence he is in because of that sweet yoga maya that is there. We have all experienced this to a different extent. You know, just now he's asking the most deepest of questions and seeking the deepest of experiences. And a moment later when Swami asks, what is it that you want? Hislop asks Swami, can you repair the ring? And Swami says, only that? And Hislop immediately says, whatever Swami pleases will delight me. I think that's again credit to the kind of spiritual being Hislop is, because he instantly realizes and gets back to the statement of surrender, which is, Swami, whatever pleases you will delight me. I have no choices or desires of my own. So that's really a tribute to him. He says that, and when he says that, Swami holds a broken ring between his thumb and forefinger and blows his breath on the ring. Immediately, there is a new ring which Swami passes on to the college boys for them to pass it around. When the ring is returned back to Swami, he takes the left hand of Hislop and puts the ring on the ring finger, that is the fourth finger. It is a beautiful golden ring with a delicate filigree setting. It has a large enamel stone and oval on it, with a smiling portrait of Swami in a light blue background. So, as per what Hislop desired, he gets a new ring. And what struck me was, the moment you tell Swami, whatever you wish, I'm happy with it, paradoxically, you seem to get whatever you have wished for also. In life, we are pursuing some things of the world. How much ever we try, it seems to be going away from us. As Swami would say, when you move away from the light, your shadow keeps getting longer and longer, and try as hard as you might, you'll never be able to catch the shadow. Instead, stop, turn around and start moving towards the light. Your shadow will also decrease in size. Plus, the shadow will start following you now. it will start following you. So also, the moment we turn to God and start moving towards God, the worldly desires come down automatically, and automatically they seem to be following, they seem to be chasing us rather than the other way around. So that's what happens here. Swami, the moment he says, whatever Swami, whatever pleases Swami, it will delight me. Swami also fulfills his desire of a new ring and gifts him with a newly materialized ring.
And for those of us who have spent a few years with Swami, in fact, even those who have not had the opportunity to really come to Swami, we all know that this is probably one of the common occurrences in Swami's presence, because we kind of associate that with Swami, materializations and characteristic way of waving his hand and bringing out something. We've always seen that, and Swami would always add something which is profound, reminds us of, you know, whose presence we are. This is not merely a materialization, it should not be seen like that. Many, many times when Swami would materialize something, it would have a backstory which is very subtle. I remember once, I think when we were students in Thrai Vrindavan, there was one student who had written a letter to Swami, and he had mentioned about his mother's sickness. His mother was having some kind of a skin problem or something like that, and he had written about that. So Swami read through the letter, and Swami asked him, you know, what is she taking and what is the problem and all that. And then finally Swami tells him, I'll give you medicine. And then Swami told, actually that medicine is not there in the world, but it is there in Sai stores, Swami said. And of course eventually Swami only gave him vibhuti and that kind of curtailed that ailment that she was having. But something like that sweet which will always be added. And so many times we've seen Swami will come and say that I'm going to ask a question and somebody who answers will get a materialization. But that will always have a backstory. You know, that person would have asked for something, that person would have thought that, you know, this day something should happen. I'm sure 90% of those stories have lost, because Swami would have done it only purely for, you know, 1%, 2% to know, to enjoy that moment. And I think even in this case, Swami is giving a very, very beautiful explanation for what he has done. And I think it's very profound. And Swami is saying, after giving Hislop the ring, Swami says, in the world, the metal, the stone and the jeweler are separate. As is the one who will take the ring. And they must be brought together. Whereas in the world of Swami, the metal, the stone, the jeweler and the one who will take the ring are all one. And that one is God. In the world, time is needed, but God is beyond time. Immediately the ring is ready. Right? It's not merely of a materialization of a ring, but I mean, how many of us would have thought of this? And Swami saying that here is a ring, it has got an enamel on it, and probably it's got a design on it. To get something like this done in the real world, yes, it takes time, but it involves different entities, right? You need probably a metal, you know, a goldsmith. You need somebody who shapes that gem or whatever, and somebody who makes that ring, and somebody who gives and somebody who receives. And Swami says, from my point of view, there is no difference at all. All of this is one. The ring, the metal, the stone, the giver and the receiver is one. So there is no time, right? The fact that Swami materialized the ring right then, we all look at it and say that, oh, you know, Swami just instantly did it. But the reason behind that is there is no difference in Swami's perception, and so there is no place for time in the whole process.
Beautiful. At this point, a visitor who is seated nearby says, it would be of interest if Baba would do a large creation. You know, create something maybe 4 feet or 5 feet in size. And Swami says, since Swami has taken a body, he has imposed certain proper limitations on himself. Swami has created idols of gold and could just as easily create a mountain of gold. So it's almost like, you know, can a inspector of police break the traffic rules and traffic light? Yes, of course he can. But will he? Generally he won't, unless there's an exception. There's a emergency or there's an outstandingly exceptional situation around. In the same way, I think Swami also, having taken on the human body, adheres to all the dharma of the human body. It's only in some exceptional cases that he, if we can say, breaks the rules that bind. Those are those moments when the clouds are parted and you get to see the bright shining sun. You get to see beyond the maya and the reality of who Swami is. But otherwise, generally, he follows the dharma of the body, rules of the body. You know, in that sense, you can ask, why did Swami have to eat? Why did he have to drink? Yes, there have been occasions when he has not had food for days together, but generally he would eat, generally he'll drink. He has borne great difficulty even as a child. He is capable of that, but otherwise generally he will take care of his body. So, having come with a body, he follows the rules of the body unless an exceptional situation demands that he do otherwise. And later on, I think Swami will make that also very clear that in any avatar it is like that, wherein the initial few years are meant for leelas and later years are meant for the teachings. Whether it's Rama or Krishna or anybody, it's only as a child that you see the maximum number of leelas, and that is how it is with the Sai avatar also. So all the miracles are also done with a purpose, as a visiting card, as Swami says. It's not for pradarshana or show, it's for nidarshana, or to direct and transform. And I think the best way to summarize it would be through the same example of the police inspector. Can the police inspector break the traffic lights? Yes, he can. But will he break it? No, not unless there's an exceptional situation that is warranting it.
And probably this question which this visitor is asking, it would be of interest if Baba would do a large creation. We can't clearly say that it is coming out of the fact that probably he doubts what Swami has done, or probably he doesn't doubt it with the idea that, you know, if Swami could do something really phenomenal in that sense, which cannot be questioned at all, then it kind of establishes the miraculous action. But I think this is clearly the limitation of the human mind, if you look at it. As I always think like this, you know, Swami materializes something, and you think that Swami, even this can be probably explained, or, you know, I've seen, as people would, you know, disparagingly remark, oh, we have seen a street magician doing this, or we've seen in an act where a person can wave his hand and do some such things like this.
Mm-hmm.
So as a devotee, sometimes we look at it and say that, Swami, can you do something which my mind cannot question? Can you do something which, you know, there is no way I can reason it out and start doubting you? I think this is where the limitation of the mind is, where we think that, okay, if Swami materializes something bigger, then I'll have more faith. If Swami does something which is even more flabbergasting, then I will have more faith. Instead, we could have turned to Swami and said, Swami, give me faith, right? Instead of saying that you do something so that I'll have faith, the Swami that who can materialize a ring, who can repair a ring, who can do something like this and anything more, he can manifest faith in your mind. And I think that's, if we were wise enough, we would have turned to Swami and asked for that, rather than saying that, Swami, if you do this, then probably I'll have faith in you.
I also feel, you know, it is part of, that is another leela of Swami, because if you look at anything, you know, any miracle that Swami has performed, or any mahima that he has performed, and there are many, many stunning ones, and there are many which you and I have personally experienced. I mean, when the doctors in the Bombay hospital had said that your father has suffered a stroke, a cardiac stroke, and unless a surgery is done, there is no way that he can survive, Swami over here tells that no, it's just some gas in the stomach and nothing, no need of surgery. I was really surprised, because I didn't know what to do, because the doctors there have got, you know, documented evidence that it is a cardiac stroke. And to make matters worse, my dad comes to Puttaparthi, because I said it's better to be near Swami. And in Puttaparthi, inside the Prashantilayam premises, he collapses and he's taken to the super speciality hospital in Prashantigram. And the doctors there say that, hey, he has suffered a cardiac stroke and I think we need to take him for surgery. Again, Swami tells, no, it's some stomach gas and he doesn't need surgery. So, you know, it is so phenomenal. And just to cut the long story short, it's almost, you know, 11 years since that day. My dad has not had a surgery. He's fine. He's taking some medication and he's fine. Now, this is something that really thrilled me. It made me feel that, you know, it doesn't depend on what the doctor says, because, as they say, the doctor only dispenses medicines. It is Vaidya Narayana Hari. It is the Lord who heals. So, that is one way of looking at it. If you want, you can even think of it like, you know what, maybe Swami just got lucky. He just said that take medicine, nothing will happen. What if something had happened to my father? And because, you know, the doctors were debating there, saying that the blockage is in such a small vessel that the risk of surgery and the risk of not doing surgery are equal. So what we should do? that is the point where I just stated what Swami had said and said that no need of surgery because this is what Swami has said. And that's what, that is all it is. So the surgery was not done and my father is fine. What if 4 years later something had happened to my dad? I'm just saying, like these, there are many miracles and mahimas and leelas. The interesting thing is, it gives enough for the person with faith to have faith. It gives enough for the person with doubt to have doubt. I think this is such a beautiful thing where Swami leaves it. He doesn't impose. He says, I have done this, that's all. I don't do anything to impress. I don't want to convince. I have no objective of anything. It's just a shower of my prema. I just shower my prema where it is needed. And I move ahead with it. That's it. I don't want you to recognize it as a miracle and become my devotee. No, I don't expect anything from you. So therefore, you know, I feel that if we are able to use that and build our faith, it's a blessing for us. If we use that to build our doubt, it's our fate that way. But one thing I just feel is, irrespective of any miracle, that's the reason why there is so much of, I feel, criticism against Swami or even doubters, skeptics on Swami, because anything that Swami has done has enough in it to give faith for those who wish to be faithful. It has enough in it to give doubt for those who wish to have doubts. And I think that's where this devotee is coming, because I think he is possibly the faithful one who is hoping that Swami do something where there's no scope for doubt. But I think in this dual world, as light and darkness can never be separated, pleasure and pain can never be separated, sweet and bitter can never be separated, it's all together because it's a nature to be dual. I think faith and doubt also, till we transcend to the level of Advaita, faith and doubt also will always be together. You cannot have one without the other. Faith has no meaning unless there is doubt, and doubt has no meaning unless there is faith. So therefore, as long as we are in the state of Dvaita, we will have this. That is why possibly, you know, like Hislop, we too should move to the state of Vishishtadvaita, finally to Advaita.
And as I was just saying, you know, many of these materializations, standalone, you will look at them, it's a miraculous event, and you know, Swami materialized this way. And just with rings, I think we've seen so many types of materializations. One which I recall, one of my seniors saying was, I think when the famous mandolin artist, Mandolin Srinivasan, and his brother were performing in Swami's presence, Swami materialized two rings which were actually interlocked.
Oh.
And sitting close to the stage, they saw that, you know, when Swami held up the ring, they could make out that one ring was into the other one, you know, just like in the form of an eight. In front of everybody, Swami blew it and, you know, pulled out
separated
the two.
Right?
And many, many such things. But if you look at it, I was just probably not related to a ring or any such physical materialization. I was listening to the talk by our senior brother Ravi Kumar, who's, you know, the famous singer and who works in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about, you know, many people come and tell him, appreciate him for his singing abilities and the fact that he's been singing for Swami for so many years. So he was saying that, you know, it's so easy to forget and think that you are doing it for Swami. You don't realize that this is an opportunity that Swami has given, whoever it is, you know, however long.
It is
long,
Swami doing it for you.
Right? It is Swami who has allowed you to do it, who has given you that opportunity to do it. So he was narrating that incident where when he was studying in Swami's school, for many, many years he had this problem that any slight issue of cold or flu that he would get, his tonsils would get inflamed and he would suffer immensely. So I think when he was in 8th or 9th standard, his parents decided to take him to a doctor in one of the cities, and the doctor looked at him and said, you know, it's a clear case of tonsils getting inflamed and they need to be surgically removed. Right? It's a small operation and the boy is young, so it shouldn't be a problem. We can get it done. And we know that many, many students in Swami's hospital have gone through this surgery, and you know, Swami has permitted them. And the thing is, if you're a student of Swami, you can't let the doctor touch you without taking Swami's permission. So he told his parents that I have to go and ask Swami. And Swami said, yes, you confirm from Swami and then we'll go ahead with the surgery. So he was sitting in the darshan line, and one day Swami comes up to him and he says, Swami, this is what the doctors are saying. Swami paused for a moment and Swami said, it's okay, it's just a small surgery, but I doubt if you'll be able to sing after that. Right? And just a couple of months back, Swami had permitted him to start singing in the mandir. Right? And that was like a, you know, bolt for him. He said, no, Swami, then I can't do that. You know, I can't give up this opportunity. And Swami said that, and Swami started walking away. And he's like, Swami, you have to tell me yes or no. Right? You left it hanging like that, and you have to tell me because I have to go and tell my parents. So Swami walked a few paces and he turned back. And Swami said, not required.
Okay. Mm.
And he said that was the end of the story of the tonsils. It never happened again thereafter. So he was saying, see, it's a miracle. There's no doubt about that. Swami cured me. But if not for that, I would not be singing today. Right? So can I claim that I am the one who is singing and offering this to Swami? Or has Swami given me this, whatever is required for me to be a singer and be able to, you know, offer this to Swami?
I like that statement, you know. We think that we are doing this for Swami, not realizing that in the process it's actually Swami doing it for us.
Right.
Whether we think that we are speaking for Him, or we are writing for Him, or we are working for Him, we have to realize that when I am thinking that I am speaking for Him, it is actually Swami, you know, doing it for me. Swami is making me speak for my own benefit. When somebody is thinking that they are working for Swami, it is Swami making them work for their own benefit. We don't do anything for Swami. It is Swami who does everything for us. On that thought, dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break, after which we'll continue this interesting conversation.
Oh,
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were discussing about an episode that just happened in the interview room where the discussion is happening, where Swami took a ring which had been given to Hislop earlier, which was broken, and he was wearing it on a chain. I think, again, something which many of the devotees and students of Swami would do when the ring breaks or something like that. And Swami blows at it, repairs it, and I think even changes it into something which is different and gives it back to him. As you said, it's something we've seen happening so many times in Swami's presence. In fact, I'm not absolutely sure of the episode, but there is an episode in Professor Kasturi's life where the ring that Swami had given him breaks, and he sees that Swami does do this repair thing also, and he's, hoping, with all his heart that one day Swami will ask him what happened to your ring. I think the picture of Swami falls off. Mm. The enamel or the gold picture, gold thing which is there on the silver ring, it falls off. So he writes as how on many, many occasions he tries to draw Swami's attention to his finger with that broken ring. And he would say that I would do namaskar in such a manner that Swami can see my ring.
But and, it didn't.
It never happened. And finally, one day, Swami takes the ring and blows it and it vanishes.
Oh, you lose everything.
Right. He said, oh God, what did I do? And of course, the next day, Swami calls him and gives him a new ring. But there are many, many episodes like this. It's a very common occurrence. And sometimes when you think of it, what a thing it is that we speak of such things and say it's a rare occurrence. Right? On the other day when we were talking about Vibhuti materializing in somebody's pictures in somebody's home, Swami's picture in somebody's home, we're like, yeah, it happens in so many devotees' houses, hundreds of devotees. To live in a time where we think that this is a common occurrence, I think that itself is such a grand unspoken blessing that Swami has given us.
Mm. Absolutely. In fact, next question that Hislop asks Swami is, because when you say Vibhuti manifesting in so many homes, I think that also in a way answers this next question that Hislop is asking, where he says, Swami, people are thinking that after the 60th birthday, Bhagwan Baba will step away from contact with the world and that his devotees will no longer have access to him. And Swami replies, no, not at all. Sai is not separating from the world, nor will he separate from his devotees. The course of an avatar goes invariably through the same stages. It is the same for every avatar at all times. The first 16 years are characterized by constant leelas, then leelas and teaching up to age of 45. From age 45 to 60, the emphasis is almost wholly on teaching. At age 60, there is a very big change. So Swami says, it is the same across all avatars. And I think the most reassuring statement over here is when Swami says that he will never separate from his devotees. It's almost like, you take care of the devotion in your heart. I'll ensure that I never leave you. Because it just reminds me of an experience. My mother used to constantly tell me that, come what may, don't let go of Swami. Let ensure that Swami is always with you. This should be your only prayer. So I used to write letters in which the sentence that I would make sure that I include is, Swami, whatever happens, never let go of my hand. Swami, whatever happens, never let go of my hand. And interestingly, the letters which I write this, Swami is not accepting it physically in the mandir. I would try everywhere, in the third block, or the fourth block, the different areas, different strategic spots. We build our own theories on where the probability of Swami taking a letter is high, where it is low, in the portico, behind the birthday boys. All this is the play of the mind. You see Swami coming and blessing the birthday boys. You think that, oh, Swami will not disappoint the birthday boys. He will definitely take all their letters. So you sit behind them, try to give the letter. Whatever I tried, nothing worked. And then I had a dream in which Swami is coming straight to me. I am seated in the end of the first portico. And Swami comes to me and tells, hey, you get up. I want to tell you that you are praying wrong. So I didn't know what. Swami said, I will never let go of your hand. You ensure that you don't let go of my hand. And Swami walked back. That is when the realization struck me. So from that day on, incidentally, I struck away that sentence from my letter. And now that sentence got modified into, Swami, please ensure that I never leave your hand. Because I felt that even that is left to him only. So in that sense, Swami is clearly telling here that I will never leave my devotee. I will never become far from my devotees. Implicitly what it means is you ensure that you are a devotee. That's enough. You can rest assured that I'll do my part. You just take care of the fact that you are a devotee. Be a devotee. And I think multiple times we have discussed Swami's definition of a devotee. A devotee is he or she who accepts and welcomes everything that comes in life as a gift from God, as Swami's prasadam, in an attitude of total surrender.
Once we were talking to one of the Sai youth from Canada. She comes from a family of devotees. She's born into that family. Mm. So she was saying that from a very young age, it was like always worshipping Swami. And she said, I was in a very different environment compared to the rest of my classmates. I used to be to myself, and she used to, you know, always try to talk to Swami and keep thinking about Swami, you know, do whatever the devotees usually do, likitanam, japam, and all of that. So she was saying that about the first 12 or 13 years of her life, there was nobody who was as close to her like Swami. You know, she would not even go and confide to her parents as much as she would tell Swami, and she would feel that Swami is always with her. And I think the first time she came for Swami Darshan was at the age of 13 or 14.
Mm.
And she said the first time I came to Parthi, which was like probably around the year which is under discussion, so, you know, 60th birthday or something.
Mm.
So when she comes and she sees Swami, and she suddenly realizes that this Swami is so far away. Right? She says, oh my God, I mean, you know, imagine that as a child you've built up this relationship with Swami, and suddenly you come and you find that he's so distant. He doesn't recognize you. He doesn't come and speak to you. I mean, it's understandable from, you know, our mature minds or in that sense. But from a child's point of view, this is your closest friend. This is the person who you always imagined as the one who, you know, probably holds your hand when you go to sleep, goes with you to school and everything, and suddenly he's like so distant, so regal in his presence and all these great people around him. So she said, I felt distant from Swami when I came physically to Swami. And I thought that was a very, very profound observation, because what Swami is saying here is again relating to the physical body. Swami is saying that till 16 something happens, till 32 years something happens. That age is clearly a reference to the body. So if you really are going to get attached to the body, then you will get distant from Swami. But the fact that hundreds and thousands of devotees feel close to Swami, many of them have not even seen Swami, I think that is a validation, or that is the proof of what Swami is saying here, that I will never be distant from my devotees. You get attached to my body, yes, you will go through the roller coaster ride. And I think to a certain extent, most of us have gone through that.
Hmm.
Where we got attached to that body, and then, you know, one day Swami speaks, one day Swami doesn't speak, and we know that one day that he chose to withdraw that form altogether. And that we go through that up and down. But anybody who really looks at Swami the way you're supposed to look at him and get attached to him, I think Swami says that you will never be distant from me.
Then comes a very interesting theme. I mean, interesting in the sense we have got some very good material here. That's why I say that. Where Hislop says, the crucifixion of Christ, the metal figure of Christ on the cross that Swami created, the metal, when strongly magnified, appears to be more or less covered with small bumps. What are they? You know, just to give a background to our listeners, Swami had materialized a crucifix with Jesus Christ on it and gifted it to Hislop. And Hislop is referring to that metal figurine of Christ on the cross. And he's asking that when you see it under magnification, I think the whole thing was about 2 inches in size or 2.5 inches in size, the crucifix with Jesus Christ. So he's saying that on the metal there are some small bumps. What are those bumps? Why are they there? Before we go ahead with Swami's answer, I think it would be a good idea to listen from Dr. John Hislop himself as to how he came in possession of that crucifix. It's a very interesting story. So, dear listeners, here's an excerpt of a talk that he delivered in one of the centers in the United States of America, and there he mentions this. So let's listen to him and then we'll continue with this conversation.
Do you remember years ago how on Mahashivaratri Swami would bring the lingam up out of some place within him, would come out of his mouth, eventually then be caught in a handkerchief. You know, he would be on the platform and the devotees in front of him, and then the bhajans would start, and Swami would sing the bhajans. Then you could see that something was happening. He sort of uneasy, uncomfortable. And the bhajans would start to go faster and faster and faster and faster. And then suddenly Swami would go like that and put his hand out in the handkerchief, and out of his mouth would come this lingam. Big things. I was sitting very close to him one time, and out came this flash of light, and he had it in his hand, and it was a lingam on a platform, a little platform, with three legs. How in the world could that come up out of his throat and out of his mouth? I don't know. What one would see would be this flash of light. Whether this power and this light came out, then immediately formed into the lingam, I don't know what happened. But it went on for years. But then people got, there came to be too much publicity about it. And people in the background would start to walk around and disturb. And so then Swami said he wouldn't show the lingam anymore. He wouldn't do that anymore. So it came to an end. So then the next year on Mahashivaratri, Swami said to me, he said, Hislop, you get a taxi, and you be ready at 5 o'clock in the morning. And you take Kasturi in your car, and we're going someplace. We're going up to, and Kasturi will know where it is. That's what he didn't tell me, because he's afraid I would blab it to somebody. And Kasturi will know where it is. He'll tell you. And so we got in the car, and Kasturi said, well, keep on driving. We're going to go up to the Mysore forest. And as we went up to the Mysore forest, there was a constant procession of cars coming towards us, that is, people from all around coming to Vrindavan, hoping that the Mahashivaratri would be celebrated in Vrindavan. And, you know, everybody knows Kasturi, but all the people in the cars coming knew Kasturi. They'd seen him for years. And yet not one of those cars recognized Kasturi riding in our taxi. Complete blank, complete disguise of some sort in front of them. They couldn't even see him. So we got up to the Mysore forest. And the first thing we did, there was some college students too. Swami had sent up a bus, maybe a dozen or so college students. And the first thing we did was to ride around through the forest trying to find the wild elephant herd. What we had hoped was we would have a repeat of what had happened some years before when Swami had taken a group of devotees to the Mysore forest. Maybe all you know that story, do you? No? Well, they went into drove around the forest, then they went into a clearing. And the car stopped. And Swami got out of the car and walked some distance in front of the car. And the devotees also got out and walked in front of the car. Swami went a little further away. Nobody follows him too closely. He stays some distance away from him. And so no sooner had that happened than there was a trumpeting at the edge of the forest. And a great big bull elephant stepped out of the forest, trumpeting. Well, the devotees all turned and rushed back to the car. And Swami looked at them and said, what? You're going to leave Swami here all alone? And then, out of the forest came this giant tusker right up toward Swami. He reached Swami, and down he goes on his knees and touches his head to Swami's feet. Then gets up and goes back into the forest, and the herd disappears. So we had hoped for a replay of that. But we couldn't find any elephants whatsoever. So then, driving around, Swami selected the place where Mahashivaratri would be celebrated, where he would do it. We saw a dry stream under a bridge, and Swami said, we'll stop here. This is where we'll have it. So then we went back to the compound and came back about 6:30 for the Mahashivaratri ceremony. We got out of the car, walking down the bank to the dry river. And as we passed some bushes, Swami reached over and broke off two little twigs. And he put them like that and said, "Well, what's that, Hislop?" So I said, "Well, it's a cross, Swami." So then he takes the two twigs and puts them in his hand like that and blew several really quite long, delayed breaths into his fists. Then he opened his hand and handed me the crucifix. Well, I didn't know what to say. And I noticed a hole at the top of the crucifix. And so I said, "Well, Swami, what's that hole?" And Swami said, "Well, the cross was hung on a peg. It's not as history says. The cross was hung on a peg. And it was through this hole that was pegged to a post." So then we went on down to the river bottom, and we found that as we were sitting on the sand, we were sitting on bones, human bones. And we found it was a place where they burned bodies. And the people said, "Well, this is quite appropriate for Shiva." I didn't know what they meant when they said that, but later on I learned that that is part of the Indian tradition. And so we sat there. Then Swami sang some bhajans, and he then brought out the lingam and passed around and showed it to every one of us and put it on the table in front of him. And then he reached up and pulled out a vase out of the air, which was filled with amrit. Then he reached up and pulled a spoon out of the air. Then walked around and gave each of us a spoon of the amrit.
So that, dear listeners, is the crucifix with the small idol of Jesus Christ on it, which Hislop is referring to. You know, in the talk he later goes on to say that soon it became a very popularly photographed object. I think it was the Cowans who came and took special permission from Swami to photograph it, because Hislop wouldn't agree for anyone to even see it or photograph it without explicit permission from Swami. And then close-up photography of that was done. Those images were blown up. I remember when we came to Prashantiniliam, when I came to Prashantiniliam for the first time, I think it was in 1990 or 91, it was actually being sold in the stores here, and we had purchased it for our home. We still have that photograph at home, a close-up of this crucifix that Swami materialized for Hislop. So that is what is being spoken about here. And Hislop says, the metal figure of Christ on the cross that Swami created, the metal when strongly magnified appears to be more or less covered with small bumps. What are they? And Swami says, they are blood, knots of blood. The body was in a bad condition. It had been hurt and injured over the entire body. At death, the blood came to a sudden stop and the bumps are clots of blood. Hislop says, Swami, on the photo enlargements of the statue, it also looks as if a sort of slice of the nose had also been removed. And Swami says, the nose is whole. That is a heavy blood stain. When the face itself is enlarged, it is seen as a dead face. Swami made the metal of the body after its death. So, then Hislop continues, because of pictures being around and the story and pictures being in books, the little figure on the cross is becoming quite famous. What should be done with it? Should it be placed in the new Satya Sai Museum? I think it must be the Sanatana Samskriti Museum that is on top of the hill. And Swami says, for the museum, Swami will make a big image of Christ. The small one was for you. You keep it. And that's where the conversation ends. I don't know the current status of that crucifix, where it is, what it is. Do you have any idea? I have no idea.
No idea, really. But I think in his other book, My Baba and I, he writes more in detail about that. And there were a lot of events which are surrounding that
crucifix,
right?
Yes.
And when Swami materialized it, actually there was the sky was overcast and they heard thunderstorms and all that. And later when he goes back and he shows it to his friends in the US, Again, the same overcast condition with thunderstorms.
Yes, I remember. Even at his home in Mexico, it happens.
And then when he goes back to Bible and reads, then we can actually see that he was till that point not really a keen student of Christianity.
Hmm.
He goes back and reads in the Bible, he realizes that at the moment when Jesus was crucified, that was the precise climatic conditions which were there. The weather conditions were the same when that happened. And he said that it happened a few times whenever he showed it to somebody with a large group and talking about it. And the other thing which Swami had revealed was that the wood was from the same
cross
wood which was used to crucify Christ.
I remember Swami saying that it is totally disintegrated and okay. Swami had to reconstruct it from the atoms.
And so it took a while. That's why he says that, you know, Swami took a few
long breaths.
And long breaths.
You know, the while that you're speaking about is a few seconds, maybe a long breath.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's not that Swami requires that, but then Swami just calls your attention to some of these details. I think so, the picture of that, in case any of our listeners have not seen it, that's not quite likely, but in case anyone has not seen that image, it's there in the book My Baba and I, or probably even a Google
version.
Search should throw up the image. It's very, very
John
famous.
Hislop crucifix, yes.
Right, and the beauty is the lifelike expression on the face. And as Swami is clearly saying it was an image of Jesus Christ after he had passed away on the cross. And you can make out that, you know, the pain and the struggle on the face is so very obvious. And it's very small. I think it fits in the palm.
Yeah, it's about 2 inches maybe overall. It goes on from there because after Swami tells Hislop to keep the cross, Swami asks him, what do you make of Christmas? And Hislop says, I was never really interested in Christianity, but I have paid more attention since Swami made the crucifixion. You know, when Hislop says this, it reminds me of Swami's famous quote where he says, I have not come to start a new religion here. I want to make a Hindu a better Hindu, a Muslim a better Muslim, a Christian a better Christian.
True.
I mean, this is what an example. This is where Hislop actually goes back and he's openly declaring it here. I was never really interested. It's only because of Swami that I have gained interest. And then Swami says, I mean, what does Christmas represent? And Hislop replies, the birth of Christ is represented. And Swami then says, the 25th is not the birth. It was on the 24th near midnight.
Right. I think many of these revelations we've heard Swami relate. You know, when Swami is sitting in the portico, Swami would speak of many of these things. But as you said, it's a very, very telling thing that Swami's, you know, he's saying that I was not interested in Christianity. I think, in a sense, that was a trend which was happening in the West, where a lot of them were turning to yoga. Hislop himself was a, you know, perfect example of that. They were into hatha yoga, they were into transcendental meditation. But however noble that pursuit was, I think in the process, we forget what is there with us, right? That's what we always do. What is the value which is there in our own scriptures, we miss out. And it's so telling that I think there was that other rabbi who spoke in Swami's presence in the year 2005,
correct.
Right? I think the multi-faith conference.
Yes, multi-faith. I forgot his name, rabbi. He came with the guitar, right, singing songs.
With the guitar. In fact, he had a very, very fascinating story that he narrated, where he said in the 70s, when this was happening, when a lot of Westerners were taking interest in the yoga tradition in India, he had actually come to the Himalayas and he had become a yogi. He had taken sannyas and all of that and he had converted into Hinduism. And during his travels, he comes to Prashantinilayam and Swami calls him for an interview and Swami tells him, why did you leave your religion? Right? He was a person from a Jewish family. And Swami asks him, why have you given up your religion? And Swami says, you don't have to give up your religion to progress spiritually, and advises him. He goes back and embraces his religion again, and then he becomes a rabbi, right? And he says that I draw a lot of inspiration from what Swami has said, and I, you know, make it a part of my discourses. And he had, almost like a complete coming around of the circle, he had come to Prashantinilayam to participate in that multi-faith conference as a representative of
the Jewish religion.
Right.
I think that is Rabbi David Zeller. He is an internationally known singer, teacher, storyteller, writer and pioneer in the Jewish spirituality and meditation. He has established his spiritual teachings beyond the Jewish religion to Christians, Sufis, Taoists, Buddhists and yoga communities. After organizational development for the kibbutz movement in 1970 and living as a sadhu in India in 1971, he was professor at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology from 1975. He founded the Network of Conscious Judaism in 1980 and directed the Shevet Center for Jewish Spirituality and Meditation in Jerusalem. So that is the rabbi who had this kind of a beautiful story. It's amazing.
Right. And so many like that. I think when we spoke to Brother Sonam, one of our alumnus, he was saying that he is actually Buddhist by birth. He was saying that there are interviews where Swami has taught him about some Buddhist techniques of meditation and worship, some rituals which are which probably are supposed to be followed by his ancestors and which have been lost in time. Swami has kind of reinitiated him into some of those things. It's a clear incident, you know, if you really look at it, that is Swami's message, that every religion is an expression of somebody's pursuit to discover God or to, you know, raise one's consciousness from human to the divine. So every religion does have its merit, and that's why I think that is the basis of Sanatan Dharma itself, that there are many paths.
Every religion is nothing but a highway to God, and as Swami says, I have come to repair that ancient highway that leads man to God. So it doesn't matter which road you take, as long as you take the road, and Swami says the avatar comes to just repair all those roads. Then Hislop continues with another interesting revelation. He says, not long ago I found out something very interesting about the Christian religion. The early Christian fathers of the Eastern Church knew something of which modern Christians have no idea. The early fathers taught that one should constantly say, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. There is the constant repetition of Christ's name until the name goes into the heart, where the repetition continues without cessation. Along with the repetition of the name, the form of Christ is visualized in the mind. I learned of this through reading an old book, The Way of the Pilgrim, translated from Russian. So, Hislop is referring to the practice of Namasmarana, you know, in Christianity. It's very interesting because, as he says, rightly, in the modern times, Namasmarana is considered a very, very Hindu kind of concept. But chanting the name of God is the very basis in Christianity as well. As Swami answers him saying, as time goes on, the significant factors of the spiritual path are lost. The Christian mystics took up the repetition of the name of Christ starting about 19 years after his death. As time goes on, human nature comes to the front and the divine is put aside and forgotten. That which was taught, that which was known of the spiritual path after the time of Rama was no longer there at the time of Krishna. And that which Krishna taught was gone when Sai came. It is the same with the Buddhists, the Muslims and the Jains. So, it's very clear that this avatar, when Swami says Sambhavami Yuge Yuge, it is a necessary maintenance task almost to come over and over again, just as any road has to be repaired every few years so that the journey is comfortable. The avatar takes upon this role of repairing roads, and that's why Swami says the avatars keep coming regularly.
As one of the speakers was saying, listening to an interview where he said that, you know, how our minds work is, we've seen so many of these movies, horror movies and movies on exorcism and all that, and, you know, when there's a somebody scared of a ghost coming, you would see them, they'll hold up the Bible or hold up the cross and make the evil spirit go away. It has got so ingrained in our mind that he says that even now there are some people who think that ghosts can be driven away only by the cross. You know, even if you're a Buddhist or a Hindu or anything, right? It's almost like it's got ingrained in the mind. So like that, when you think of it, as you were saying, that we think that Namasmarana or worship in that form, or, you know, chanting of mantras, they're all very Eastern in their origin. But Swami would himself say that there's a very famous concept which Swami would speak about. There are so many syllables, I don't know exactly what it is. This one you were given to the Brahmaloka, and this one you were given to, you know, the
Swami says, words. I think a 1 lakh weather,
right.
This is with respect to the Ramayana, are you saying that?
Right.
Swami says that in the Ramayana, there are 1 lakh stanzas and they had to divide it between the humans, the Devaloka, the Daivaloka and the Manavaloka. So Swami says 33,333 were given to each. So one shloka remained. So in that, you know, when they went through, Swami says that there were, I think, 35 syllables in that or something like that. So they gave an equal number, I think 11 each to each of them. And two remained, and those two could not be divided further among three. And so it was said that these two belong to all. Everybody can make use of it. And Swami says, those are the two syllables, Ra and Ma, Rama.
Right. And whenever Swami would say that, Swami will not stop with that.
Hmm.
Swami would say that those two syllables are Rama, Allah, Sai, Yeshu. And he would say that all divine names. So it is, when you say Namasmarana, that's why, you know, the very fact that Swami's bhajans are the way they are. Because every name is considered divine, because it's, I mean, the concept of Namasmarana, we've spoken about it even in this. It's always about the name helping you recall the form, the name helping you recall the qualities of the divine form. So that is what is the thing. So how can taking the name of Jesus not be considered as Namasmarana? And I think that is the fact that Swami is saying, that every religion has it. But in your pursuit of trying to find it from elsewhere, you miss the treasures which are there in your own traditions and beliefs.
In fact, I remember reading in a discourse, I think we had mentioned it earlier also, when somebody is attempting to meditate, Swami says, when you meditate, it's like learning how to ride a bicycle. You will not get balance in the beginning. You will have many falls. But don't worry, keep at it. One day, suddenly you will get balance, and that balance you will have it throughout your life. You will be able to even drive through the most crowded streets. So Swami says, to get that balance, you need to use the handlebars. And what are the handlebars? Swami says, one side is the name of the Lord, the other side is the form of the Lord. Pick a name and form of the Lord that is dear to you, and keep moving, let your mind keep moving between the name and form. This is the way to meditate. So, you know, this example I was just sharing with one of my classmates who had been for a Vipassana meditation course and all that. And when I told this to him, he was so thrilled, because he said that though the whole course was very interesting, they have the concept of meditating on nothingness. And he said he found it so difficult, that because his mind would keep coming up with something or the other. He said, however intensely I tried, I just couldn't empty my mind. And he said that what Swami says is so beautiful, because when the mind needs definitely something or the other to focus on, it makes sense to make it focus on something that will elevate you. And like you said, the name of the Lord and the form of the Lord. Swami says, when the mind is moving away from the name of the Lord, bring in the form of the Lord. When it's moving away from the form of the Lord, bring in the name of the Lord. So I just happened to narrate to him this thing that I had read in Swami's discourse, and he was genuinely thrilled.
Mm-hmm.
I could not share his thrill, because possibly I have not gone through what he went through trying to empty his mind, but he was genuinely thrilled, and he said, this is the key, man. Why on earth am I trying to find it elsewhere? Swami has given everything so easily. Wow, this is so thrilling, so amazing. I just thought of sharing this here, because anybody else who is trying meditation and might have struggled, I'm sure we'll feel the same thrill that my classmate felt. And here it is. That's why, that shows the power of the name. I mean, it's not only about which religion you follow, whatever kind of spiritual practice also you follow, whether it's meditation, whether it's karma, whether it's through action, anywhere, the name of the Lord is definitely a boost. I would like to tell from my own personal experience, whenever I feel very worried, whenever I am sad, whenever I am angry or frustrated, or I feel that, you know, things are just not going fine, I just start chanting the Sai Gayatri. Sai Shwaraya Vidmahi Satyadevaya Dhimahi Tanna Sarva Prachodayat. And you know, continuously, I don't keep a count or anything, like continuously for half an hour, that is the thing that's going on. I don't do it loudly, but I do it so intensely that sometimes even my lips are moving, you know. I keep doing it. And believe it or not, Prem, 100% of the times within half an hour, I am feeling definitely much better. Definitely much better. I'm feeling much more relaxed, calm, the rapid heartbeat ceases, I'm feeling comfortable, it all settles. It's not as if the problem is solved, but I'm in a definitely much better state. And this I have something I've experienced practically, therefore there is a lot of power, there's a lot of vibration in the name, and it doesn't matter what religion you belong to, what kind of sadhana you're trying, repetition of the name, even like, you know, like a tape recorder almost, just rapidly, like how I do, helps a lot.
And there are many, many devotees, you know, who have come to Swami. In fact, the first few chapters of Satyam Shyam Sundaram replete with examples of people who are devoted to Shirdi Baba, who came to Swami, who are devoted to many, many other gurus. You know, they had their own family gurus who brought them to Swami. But Swami would, you know, give them a glimpse that it was the same. The wisdom is coming from the same place. But at the same time, Swami would never ask them to give up one and embrace the other. You know, we were once talking to a devotee from Canada. I think last year for Christmas we had published an article by her. So she says that, you know, when as a child, the first time she hears about Jesus and she reads the Bible, she says that she's completely lost her heart to Jesus. And she said ever since, you know, she's always lived with Jesus as her companion and friend and all of that. And then she comes to Swami and she says that, for me, it was never difficult to accept Swami because I did not find any difference in the message, difference in the approach to life as such. And she says that at one point she actually tells Swami that, Swami, I'm not able to reconcile between the two, Jesus and Swami. And she says, I love both. But she says that there are two for me, you know, literally in that sense. And Swami's simple answer was, Swami said, don't try. He said, it's fine that, you know, you have love for both and it's not, I mean, in your mind it is two. There will come a time when you find that not only these two, but no, there is no multiplicity at all. But it doesn't matter. And I think that is the universality of Swami. And when we want to represent Swami or when we want to claim to be part of Swami's organization, Swami's fold, we should have the same universality in our approach to life.
Absolutely. After that, you know, I think it's a new day beginning there because it's a new theme or it's maybe another interview. It's very interesting. We've got a few minutes. Maybe we can go through the few statements. Swami asks Hislop, what is your work in America? And Hislop says, I'm retired and I do no work. So Swami says, then how do you pass the days? Hislop replies, mostly the day is spent with Swami. It starts with Swami in the morning and goes through the day. I work at my desk trying to make sense out of my financial affairs, and then there are many tasks in relation to the house. But really, Bhagwan is our life. Our discrimination, added to by our direct experience, tells us that Baba is God himself. So what else is there? What else can there be? And Swami says, it's a good opportunity for you to study Sai's teachings. I found Hislop's honesty very, very refreshing over here. He says, Swami, yeah, I'm retired, nothing much. I sit and try to sort my financial affairs. I'm work, home, work of the house is there, that's it, but nothing much I do. Because, you know, when I imagine myself in Swami's presence and Swami asks, what do you do? I think the marketer in me or the advertiser in me would pop up and try to, you know, embellish whatever little that I'm doing as well, you know. But here, it's very plain, it's very nice, very wonderful to see this kind of friendship and honest conversation. So Hislop just says that, and Swami says, then it's a good opportunity for you to study Sai's teachings. And then, you know, Hislop says, Swami must tell me what he wants the chairman of the Central Committee of America to do. I think that's himself. He's referring to himself in the third person. That will be my work now. And Swami says, you will need to do quite a bit of touring, visiting the Satya Sai Baba centers. For this, since you are now retired, you should not pay off your own pocket. Which means if you are not retired, you travel, you make it a priority for yourself, you travel and do. But so this is a conversation that Swami has and it continues. But I think unless there is something for you to wish to add, we'll stop at this point. And we will not be continuing this next week because the next week is going to be in the heart of the Dasara season and we will be having the Yagnam, the Veda Purusha Saptaha Jnana Yagna that will begin in the Purnachandra Auditorium on the 2nd of October. So I think the next Thursday falls on the 3rd, if I'm not mistaken. So on that day, we will take up something related to the yagna that Swami has himself stated, some interesting experience related to the Vedic practices and all of that. So that is a theme that we'll take up next week. And if it spills over, maybe to another week. So for the next week, we'll be taking a break from the conversations with Sri Sathya Sai Baba, and we'll be taking up a Dasara theme. On that note, dear listeners, we will bring this satsang to a close. We'll end with a song, on the other side of which you will be greeted as always by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love.
Let thy will be done.